Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio for Saturday the 7th of November. This week we take a short trip down to Wells in Somerset and hear why one man believes small newsagents are being squeezed out of business by powerful multinationals such as Tesco's, and also how the Daily Telegraph free newspaper voucher scheme forced him out of business. We also pay a visit to Arnold's Vale Cemetery and find out how the Vietnam War really started and what it was all really about. And we return to Somerset again to take a rain check on the music scene generally, and blues in particular, from musician Chris Betts. Martin Cook's family used to run Cook's News Agents in Wells for generations, but he found it increasingly impossible financially to carry on. Dialect's Tony Gosling went down to find out why Martin thinks it's becoming so difficult for small family businesses to survive.
The name is Martin Cook. My family actually had a newsagent business in St Cuthbert Street in Wells. It was started in 1927 when my grandfather was left from being manager of W.H. Smith's to start his own business. And I was running it from 1981 with my parents up to 2007. Then I just had a bit of unfortunate health trouble, so I'm better now. So I've now got two tenants in there which are running a retro coffee bar. Unfortunately, the business has changed, but with the way the newspaper has changed, I think I made the right decision to come out of it at the right time.
Now, you've seen quite a lot of changes in the ownership of the various newspapers around here. How have they changed, you know, sort of since the 1960s and 70s?
Well, the Wells Journal was started about 100 years ago under the family name of the Clare brothers, and that is now under the ownership of Northcliffe. Prior to Northcliffe, it did belong for a short period of time to Bristol United Press.
Tell us more about the circumstances which led you to have to close the business, because it wasn't just due to health, was it?
Oh, no. There was a combination. I think the problem caused my sort of health reasons. I actually dedicated a lot of my time into supporting a home delivery business of up to about 500 customers a day. And a lot of those customers were paying direct to the papers, like the Daily Telegraph particularly, who had the deal of readers could have the papers either free or half price by contracting a payment direct to the Telegraph. But that's all very well, as long as the vouchers which the customers were actually handing into the newsagents were actually credited back to the wholesalers quick enough. I did have a very unfortunate thing happen at Quites. After posting the vouchers by recorded post, a package of a value of about £800, this happened a couple of times, went missing in the post. At the time, I then mentioned this to the bank who I was dealing with, and they said, well, we can't do anything about it. The vouchers are now, there's no cash value. And I said, well, that's not right. And this is because there was two younger managers took over from a very senior, well-experienced senior bank manager who understood the voucher situation. Partly the reason he was also a customer of mine, he took up the offer. And so I then didn't know what to do about this £800 at the time. So I spoke to my insurance company.
Yeah, because I was going to say, surely you should be insured for the loss of something like that.
Yes, basically my insurance company, and I'll mention a name there, that's NFU. They went away after a couple of days to check with their underwriters, and they came back and said, well, you are covered for cash in transit, so realistically the vouchers are a form of cash. And after a couple of weeks they did honour my claim. But the problem is, the damage had already been done then, So
it must have been an interruption of your cash flow, you know, quite a big one.
Oh, yes. The vouchers I was handling was anything up to about £700 to £900 a week.
So let's just recap there, because the idea being that people who are getting the paper delivered to their door are actually not paying you, the newsagent. They are paying the Daily Telegraph, and the Daily Telegraph is then reimbursing you.
That is correct. They were reimbursing people such as me, but not actually with cash, because the vouchers I collected from the customers was going back to the wholesalers and going round the circle, and then the actual cash term would only come off on an invoice value. I never actually seen the cash. I did joke it sometimes. I was almost become a cashless business. But if it were, if the system worked well and the credits happened quick enough, it would be a guaranteed way of taking risk away. But this means the wholesalers had to get their act together. Incidentally, the main wholesaler covering this area now is also gone out of business, and that is Dawson News.
And do you think that's partly due to this system, or any idea why Dawson are now out of business?
I think the policy which Dawson News actually set up wasn't foolproof enough to cater for the amount of vouchers, and they were under pressure by the publishers, and they were then pushing the pressure down to the independents. I've known of about 14 news agents in this area who have had to go out of business, basically, for exactly the same reason.
So who's taken over then? I mean, obviously the supermarkets sell newspapers, and who's taken over from Dawson News as distributors?
Well, small world, really. In this area, there's a company called Dashed, who I don't know anything about now, but in the Bristol area, WH Smith have actually got the contract back. And
so it must mean that this has damaged a lot of small local businesses, particularly news agents are, you know, quite important in that they're shops that people often go into every day, and that they generate some kind of retail experience that is not the kind of the normal supermarket thing. And many of those businesses, of course, will be in villages, maybe the only shop in the village.
That is correct. And I honestly think the closure of all the post offices across the country has been huge profile with the MPs and everything, but exactly the same thing has actually happened to the independent news agents. And the old saying is, you always want the small shop, the independent news agent. There's that humorous saying, you use it or lose it, which has actually come true.
Now, what do you think is the benefit of small shops like your shop used to be?
Well, there's two things. The shops, like I used to operate it, it was family run. We knew all the customers by name, and we were more of a social service. One thing, I was employing up to 10 young people a day delivering newspapers, and I always thought young people, that was their first opportunity to get on the responsibility of employment. So not only the voucher systems damaged the trade, it's also taken out the experience for young people going into their first job.
So can you see these small shops springing up again in the future in any way, and if so, how?
Well, you never say never, because history has got a habit of actually repeating itself. And I honestly think people will regret the move. And the bigger the, Tesco Town, etc. gets, they're going to take over so much. And all of a sudden, even some of the big supermarkets are actually going to sort of break up, and they're going to go bust one of these days, in my opinion, because you can only put so much into a balloon, and then it bursts. And now places like Tesco's and Sainsbury's are now moving into banking. Now, is that the reason they're moving into banking? Is because they've now saturated every other person's businesses, and the cash flow is starting to dry up within them.
So you still own your premises in Wells, where you used to have a newsagent. Can you ever see yourself, or maybe you running a business, which is a newsagent from there again?
You never say never. My daughter, who is currently studying at Norland College in Bath, but one of these days, young people like to go back into family businesses. The business premise I've got, as you just said, is I've got leased out as a retro coffee bar. But who knows, the opportunity could come. You might see a re-emergence of the independent newsagents. You never say never.
Thank you to Martin Cook there. He used to run a newsagent in Wales, explaining to Starlink's Tony Gosling why he feels it's becoming increasingly difficult for small businesses to survive.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Last week, eagle-eared listeners will remember you heard the first part of a feature on Arnos Vale Cemetery, which is being renovated with the help of a grant from English Heritage. This week you can hear part two as Dialect's Anthony Page continues her heritage tour with guide Dave Napier.
Dave Napier, and I'm a friend of Arnos Vale Cemetery, and I've been doing voluntary work here for about 4 years now. And one of the things I do is coordinate the heritage tours around the cemetery.
We're standing right in the middle of the cemetery now, stopped in front of a lovely angel. She's about 4 foot high.
Well, angels have been around in cemeteries right from the start, and they've been in church graveyards. Angels basically are messengers of God, so they've come to escort the departed to heaven. And you can see this one's pointing upwards, basically saying, this is where we're going, mate.
This one's interesting. It doesn't look like a...
People would go to a monumental mason. In some cases, the mason might have something in his yard which attracts their attention. It may have been a piece that he recovered from a building that he thought looked good. So we've got a piece that looks like a piece from it that might be on a church, and it could well have been one of those particular pieces I've described where they said, oh, that would look good on our tomb, and here it is. I mean, over there, if you look that way, there's one which is a mixture of what looks like nice, cleanly carved stone and very old, crusty stone. Well, that one's been put together from a church somewhere, and that stonework's been incorporated in the monument. You can see here we've got a grave with three crosses in three circles, which is representative of the Holy Trinity. The grave itself is the last resting place of one Dr. William Budd. Now, Dr. Budd was very important for Bristol and other cities like it because he was one of the early medical men who recognised the connection between the awful epidemics that were inflicting themselves upon the cities, typhoid and in the 1830s, cholera. And the sanitary conditions, or rather the lack of proper sanitary conditions. And although he didn't fully understand it, he realised that there was a strong connection between those epidemics and the fact that people weren't separating their drinking water from the other water properly. He campaigned throughout his life for that to be put right. And it's interesting that between the time he was in Bristol, when he came to Bristol, as far as the death rate is concerned, Bristol was the second worst place in the country to be living. By the time he died, it was the second best place in the country. Another indication is that in 1849, when cholera came to Bristol for the second time, 450 people died. And in fact, they were all buried here in Arnos Vale Cemetery. But when it came again in 1865, and by then Dr. Budd's implementations had taken place, we only lost 25 people. And in that same epidemic, we lost 25, Swansea lost 400. So that just shows the effect of this man's work.
Where did the cholera come from? Did it come from the ships?
Yes, it came. It was endemic in southern India. And with the trade developing between India and Europe, it spread across Europe. The British knew it was coming. And it actually hit places like Bristol, which was a big port, in 1831.
To our right, there's a fantastic monkey puzzle tree.
Yep.
Is that the only one here?
It is now. There were two. The monkey puzzle trees really weren't available for people to plant in their gardens till 1840. But as soon as they were available, everybody wanted one who had a garden. And Arnas Vale, being one of the best gardens in the country at that time, had at least two. The other one was planted down by the gate. Sadly, that one was cut down by that chap who I told you about was trying to develop the cemetery. But he didn't chop this one down, thankfully. But you can see it's quite a big one, and it's probably been there since the 1840s. We've moved into a slightly later area of the cemetery than we were walking in. You can see the trees here, which are all long and spindly. Back in the 1980s, they decided that they needed to do something about the tree growth, but they didn't think very carefully about what they should do. And they got someone in to cut all the trees down. But of course, if you cut an ash tree down and just leave it, you're likely to get at least two grow in its place. And what's happened here, all these were cut down, and then they all started to grow at the same time. So over the last 20 or 30 years, they've all been fighting for the same amount of light and space, and they've all grown very tall and very thin.
We stopped in front of the tomb of George Muller, who was quite a well-known Bristolian.
Except he wasn't a Bristolian. He was actually a Prussian who came over to England to learn to be a preacher. Well, first of all, he went to Devon, but then he came to Bristol to preach. And when he came to Bristol, he was very concerned about the plight of the children he saw on the streets, who appeared to be orphans. George, being a preacher, the first thing he could think of doing was praying. And within a short period of time, the story goes that he was given his first shilling, and that was the first of many, many hundreds of thousands of shillings. He collected them, and within a fairly short period of time, he had enough money to get a house down in Wilson Street in St Paul's, where he set up his first orphanage for 40 girls. He carried on collecting money, and a few years later he was able to open a second orphanage and another house in the same street for babies. And then again, he opened a third house in the same street, and this time for boys. So he had three houses in the same street, full of kids. Then he carried on collecting money, and after about 10 years, I think, he had enough to start building the orphanage buildings on Ashley Down, which of course most Bristolians are aware of. They're not orphanages any longer. They were educational buildings for a long time.
We're outside another chapel now. Which one's this one?
Well, this is the Nonconformist Chapel. You can see that it's also an imposing building like the Anglican Chapel, but I think it's much more beautiful. It's in nice proportion, and it's got those lovely Ionic columns in the front of it. When they finish working on it, it's going to look really good in this setting.
This is pretty amazing. This is the tomb of...
He's known as the Raja Ramohan Roy. A Raja was an honorary title. He actually came to this country as an emissary, and he had a number of purposes in being here. One was to discuss with the British government the recent law that had been passed in 1829 outlawing the practice of suti, which was disposing of the widow of the departed by throwing her onto her husband's funeral pyre alive. And it was a practice which needed to be stopped. The Raja Ramohan Roy wanted to do something about it in particular, because when he was a child, he'd attended the funeral of his older brother, and to his horror, he saw this happen to his sister-in-law. So eventually, he and many other people did do something about it. They had this law passed, and he wanted to make sure that the British government made sure the law was imposed and wasn't just forgotten about conveniently, just on a political gesture, you know. That was one reason he came to this country. Another was for sort of religious reasons. He was very interested in bringing people together. I mean, he's important to the Indian nation today because in many ways he's seen as the father of modern India, politically speaking. He was the one who brought all the various sects of the Hindus together so that they had a kind of a concept of being one unity. And that led on to the concept of India being a separate country and one which would exist without the control of the British. He was certainly a linguist. He could speak many languages. English wasn't his first tongue, but he spoke it very well. And when he came to England, he addressed groups of people here, and indeed he came to Bristol with a particular reason to visit a chap called Dr. Lant Carpenter, who was the pastor of the Unitarian Church down in Lewin's Mead, and he preached in that church, this Hindu gentleman. And the reason why was because he was hoping that he could build bridges between Hindus and Christians.
Can you just describe the tomb, because it is magnificent?
Well, it's called a chatri, and it looks typically Indian in its style. It's a big solid square building going up about maybe 25-30 feet. The roof, which is domed, is supported by pillars. There are three pillars on each corner, so we've got four corners, so that's 12 pillars supporting this pretty heavy roof.
It looks like a mini temple.
Well, yes, it is in a way. In fact, it was in danger of falling down. The foundations were found to be shaky, and some movement had already occurred, and if it had continued, the whole thing would have collapsed. But it's a measure of this man's importance to India that there was an Indian gentleman who saw fit to donate £50,000 to pay for the restoration of this monument.
That was reporter Anthony Page talking to Dave Napier, a heritage guide at the Arnold's Vale Cemetery near Temple Mead Station in Bristol.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Chris Milligan runs something called the Conspiracy Theory Research List, but his father used to work for the US Central Intelligence Agency, so he has more knowledge than most about what is true and what is disinformation. He also believes the US likes to fake battles and start wars that they will ultimately lose because it enables them to smuggle drugs over long periods of time. Chris believes that intelligence agencies, under cover of official secrecy, have been running illegal drugs around the world for generations, as he explains to Dialect's Tony Gosling.
My father told me in September of 1969, he said the Vietnam War is about drugs, there's these secret societies behind it all. And then he ended up telling me that they're playing out a loose scenario during that. And then later on, he, in 1956, he was meeting with Colonel Lansdale in Thuy Ninh, Vietnam. And in speaking to my mother after my father had died and I had gone through his papers, because I had been researching a subject I call CIA drugs, and I was looking into the history of Chiang Mai, Thailand. People have probably heard of that. It's the second largest city in Thailand. And all the banks have branches there, and it's basically a heroin city, a city built on heroin. And because I had heard that it had been just a small village in my life, and it had grown up to be this, you know, second largest city real fast because of all the heroin money. And so I was looking through my father's papers, and in this trip that he had taken in 1956, I was just a youngster, and they had told us that my father was going to go write this book on the church in Southeast Asia, which was never written. And in looking at his itinerary, I see that he's been in Chiang Mai, Thailand. So I go and ask my mother, I says, Mom, how big was Chiang Mai, Thailand? You were there in 1956. And she says, well, it wasn't very big. The biggest thing in town was this the church, and she had some pictures of it. And she pulled down her picture book, and there was a picture of the church, and, you know, like pigs in the street. I mean, it wasn't a very big village. And she made a little comment, and she said, and that's when I stopped believing everything that I read in the newspapers. And, well, that kind of perked up my ears, because my mother was a very good CIA wife. She knew nothing and would say nothing, and, you know, and just I could never get anything out of her or anything. And so finally, and so I says, well, gee, Mother, what are you talking about? And she said, well, because when they had been in Vietnam, they had gone the next day to Bangkok and then to Chiang Mai. She said there was this big story in the newspapers about this big battle in Vietnam where they had been. And she says, you know, there was no battle there. We were having a picnic, you know. And so I turned the pages back on, you know, the family picture albums and from Chiang Mai, and sure enough, there's these pictures of my father and Colonel Lansdale and my mother and a bunch of people in fatigues and black hats and stuff. And there's this beautiful picture of my mother, very vivacious, her skirts swirling. The rest of my siblings chose it as the picture for her memorial. And if you look right under her skirt, there's Colonel Lansdale, and he's sitting there, and they're obviously, you know, these guys are having a picnic. And then right next to the picture, it says my mother's name, Eudora, and it says, Eudora out from Saigon with Colonel Lansdale and North Vietnamese military leaders. Okay, so this is 1956. Okay, so they're having a picnic, and you know, we know from the historical record that Colonel Lansdale did fake battles in the Philippines. I mean, it's part of the historical record. And so they're having a picnic. They tell the world that they're having a battle. Okay, now why do they do that? Because then the people that don't know they're having a picnic and think they're having a battle in the village, in the towns and stuff, they have to start choosing sides. Okay, and then once you choose a side, then they start to harden the sides. And pretty soon they're fighting, but there's real fighting back and forth. And then what happens? They take American boys and girls, okay, and send them to hell, okay, for one year, okay, because there's a draft on, they're taking kids from all over the country, okay? And it's a draft, so you only got to be there 1 year, okay? And so they know if they survive 1 year, they get to go back home and see their boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, okay? And to survive that 1 year, some of these kids get addicted to the heroin that's offered to them by, you know, everybody that's from about 12 years old and up, okay? And because, see, after my father told me this one time, I mean, I didn't understand what he was talking about when he first told me the Vietnam War was about drugs and whatnot. But then we had some other talks and some arguments because I grew my hair long and was smoking some pot. And he was very, very concerned about me getting hooked on heroin. And he told me, he said, there's a plan to hook all you kids on drugs, on heroin. And I had to tell my dad, I said, listen, I you know, I don't like this stuff. Don't see it. Don't look for it and whatnot. And, you know, and us that lived through the 60s can, I mean, remember, I mean, marijuana in the 60s was very cheap. Heroin was very, very expensive. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of opposite today, you know. The Vietnam War, I mean, the Colonel Lansdale who I'm talking about there, it was the prototype for the Ugly American, there was another book that was also written about him there about Vietnam, and he was the U.S. presence in Vietnam right after the French, and he was been OSS and CIA, and he was the person who, just before this meeting that had happened, where my father had met this gentleman in 56, Colonel Lansdale had just recently taken over the Golden Triangle in France. And, you know, I mean, if you follow, you know, a lot of American military adventures, you find that they're going to places where opium is grown. I mean, if you look at the Balkans, especially right where they went, okay, the Balkans, if you look at any good reliable source on opium production, is always the fifth or sixth largest production out there. And, you know, of course, you know, they're camped out there in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is, you know, producing, you know, tons.
Chris Milligan there, whose father worked for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and was involved at the early stage of the Vietnam War there, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about the links between the Skull and Bones secret society, which George W. Bush was a member of, and the illegal opium and heroin trades. And you can find Chris's book publishing arm on the web at trineday.com, T-R-I-N-E, trineday.com, and find his conspiracy theory research email list at www.ctrl.org. Well, speaking of conspiracies, we have a conference taking place in Bristol in about a week's time, which is called AltView. So I've got our Tony Gosling to sit down in front of the microphone and tell us a little bit about it. What is AltView?
Well, the Alternative View conferences, John, began in Totnes in Devon in early 2008. They're put together by a guy called Ian Crane, who's an ex-oil worker. And whilst he was working in the oil industry, he saw lots of things that he thought were dodgy about the way the big multinational oil corporations work. For example, sort of cartels going on, so that price fixing, all this sort of thing. Anyway, Ian has decided to make a bit of a mission of getting to the truth in all sorts of areas. And the Alternative View Conference, well, the idea is to get really, I suppose, alternative speakers or radical speakers in all sorts of different subjects at the same venue at the same time. Mm. Now, no one's pretending that all these people are telling the truth. In fact, many of the people when they're speaking are saying, well, don't believe me, go and check these things out for yourself, whatever the subject is. Mm. And that's one of the things I quite like about it, because if you're going along to the conference, you have to sit and really decide for yourself, is this person talking total nonsense or is this really important?
Okay, so
now, I mean, you could say it's a bit naughty of him to be mixing up, you know, sort of complete nutters with really important subjects. My argument is that the conference is actually all about the audience deciding for themselves what to believe and what not to believe.
Okay, so who is going to be there? What sort of people?
We've got one of the key speakers at this conference is going to be Norman Baker MP. He's a Liberal Democrat MP. And he famously looked very carefully at the death of Dr. David Kelly, who was the government scientist who died in 2003, so-called committed suicide. Now, Norman Baker doesn't believe that he committed suicide, and there never has been a proper inquest, of course, into David Kelly's death. The importance of Kelly's death was that it was had a massive impact at the BBC with the sacking of Greg Dyke, the Director General, and demonstrations by many of the journalists outside BBC properties the day that Dyke was sacked. Mm. And basically the argument was saying that the government was interfering with the BBC politically. So the death of David Kelly was an immensely important controversy, really, that Norman Baker has looked into. Now, the ramifications of that, of course, were that the Iraq War happened. Now, David Kelly was an absolute expert, a world expert in nuclear, chemical, biological weapons. And, of course, you can see videos of him on the internet talking about these subjects. And he really was an expert. He believed, quite rightly, as it turned out, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq before the invasion, and he was saying this, and he was a very credible source saying this at the top level on the Today programme to Andrew Gilligan, who was working for the BBC at the time. So the fact that there's not been a proper inquest, which there should be by law, into Kelly's death really has left it open, and Norman Baker has taken it on as his job, which is quite brave of him, really, and he's done lots of good pulling in votes for the Liberal Party doing this, to get to the bottom of what happened that day.
All right, okay. When is Alternative View?
The Alternative View is taking place in a week's time. It starts on the Friday the 13th of November, and it goes on Saturday the 14th and Sunday the 15th of November. But let me just say one of the other guests who's going to be speaking there is Cynthia McKinney. She's a congresswoman who also spoke out very much against the Iraq War and was
also saying that, basically that George W. Bush was a war criminal. She was saying this in Congress. And the Democratic Party, she's a West Indian lady, and her Democratic Party actually kicked her out at the next vote, which is great, you know, ridiculous, really, to think that because she's speaking out against the Bush and the opposite party, the Republicans, that she then is no longer supposed to be, you know, she's seen as unpatriotic, but she's a fantastic speaker. I've seen her speak before, and Cynthia McKinney is well worth watching.
Brilliant. Well, how much is it to get in?
Well, this is the crunch, I'm afraid, John. The tickets are around about £100. So you do have to have quite deep pockets in order to go along. But what I'll be doing, if people can't afford to go themselves, I'll be going along to the conference over the weekend and trying to get some interviews with some of the key speakers.
OK, cool. Well, brilliant. Thank you very much for coming in and telling us. Independent-minded musicians are worth their weight in gold, and this guitarist with his own recording studio down in Wedmore Vale in Somerset is no exception. So here is a track from Chris Betts called Heat It Up. That was Heated Up by Chris Betts and his band The Connection. Tony Gosling went down to interview him.
My name's Chris Betts, and the solo album that you referred to goes back a couple of years. I think it was one of the last things I did before teaming up with my current band, The Connection.
You're coming from a sort of rocky, bluesy direction. Why is it that you think you've ended up in that end of music?
Well, I think if you talk to most players my age, if they're guitar-oriented or they've done touring of any sort, you come back again and again to the blues. The blues is such a rootsy, immediate, dynamic music that I was never really heavily into the country side of blues, but I remember hearing people like Buddy Guy. There was an EP out at the time, I think it was called Crazy Music, which had him really doing his thing on a semi-acoustic Gibbo. And, sorry, that's a Gibson guitar. And I was just taken with the sound from there on in. I got introduced to the blues by a guy called Humphrey. He still resides in Bristol, if you're out there, Humphrey. Humphrey Woods, who's a fantastic songwriter, and played the guitar in one of the original bands that I joined. And his brother had gone to art school and had left him a pile of these Jimmy Reed records. And I remember he and I would go through them, and he would introduce me to these Jimmy Reed tracks. And I think that was probably about the same time I heard Buddy Guy. It was probably part of his collection. So that was like a big turning point for me. I just got really taken into that music, and I've loved it ever since. So although, you know, I play a lot of others in a lot of other spheres of music, now and again, I like to come back to the blues, you know. In fact, a couple of weeks back, we did a blues club in Wells, And that was a great evening, a whole evening of, you know, Chicago-type stuff. Although I must admit, we pushed the envelope a little bit. If you're an absolute purist, then you'd probably consider that some of it is a little outside the parameters. But I think a lot of modern rock music, especially the adult-oriented rock, as they call it, for radio purposes, has got its roots deep into the blues. And I think you recognise that if you know anything about blues.
Do you think Bristol's actually quite a good place and Somerset is a good place to be doing this kind of thing? Are there lots of other musicians of similar mind you're able to hook up with for a period of time and then maybe move on?
I think the area has got a number of good outlets for music. But it's not as prolific as it has been. I think there is a great need for more and more venues, like the one that we played a couple of weeks ago in Wells there, which is just an upstairs lounge room. But people pay their cover fee. They're prepared to pay to get in. And they get a whole evening of live music instead of the canned stuff. And I'm all for that. In terms of the musicians in the area, I think it's wonderful living around here. I mean, within about 2 days of moving to where I currently live, I met about five or six local musicians who are active. You know, they weren't kind of bedroom musicians. These guys were out there doing it. So quite a lot of them, I've discovered, just live within stone's throw, you know. And that's great. I think Bristol's got a lot of music to offer. I mean, in my capacity as producing for other people in my studio, I've had quite a few Bristol bands down here. I mean, one of the ones that stands out that came back quite a lot was a group called Cyan. I think they got a comedy version of their lineup out now. I think they're called Rockmongus. You can look them up on the net. But they're a hilarious bunch of guys. And I've had some great times recording people like that. So there's loads of talent out there. It's just in working with the younger musicians, I find that's the saddest thing is they're not the amount. It's not the amount of outlets. In fact, there are even venues now. I think some of them have said that they've got to pay to play, which I think is an absolute abomination. You know, so I would love to see more and more people, you know, take an approach of doing live music.
Do you think there's more sort of piped music and canned music and less venues around for people like you in, say, big cities like Bristol?
Yeah, I think it's the quick, easy fix. I remember I did a tour with a fantastic sax player and flautist called Mike Clark. Many of you will have heard of him. He's a fantastic player. And I toured quite a lot with him. And that was one of the things that we used to get constantly on the tours in the clubs was that they would see the instruments come out and realize that you were actually going to play live for them instead of... Because a lot of the smaller clubs tend to book people who come along with a kind of, their own backing CDs, which are made up of MIDI files. Most people now seem to know what a MIDI file is. It used to be a kind of an insider's term. But, you know, just a bunch of electronic instruments talking to each other, make a backing track and sing to that. And we used to get tremendous reaction throughout some of those tours where people would come out and say, wow, you're going to do it live? And you say, yeah, that's what we do, you know. But people were kind of taken aback because they were so used to week by week going to their local small club, you know, and finding that it was another guy singing to a backing track or a mini disc, you know. So I think that's the sad aspect of it. The good aspect of it is that there's always an audience for live music. It's just that it needs more people with a little bit of savvy to do the setups, to organise these things. Once they do it, everybody says, why haven't we done this before, you know? And that's borne out by some of the local stuff that you do. Where it could be anything from, well, we've done things like harvest homes in the villages, you know. Hey, huge groups of people turn out and they love it. It's live music, you know. So I think as long as you can, as long as you've got a grasp of your craft, people will always want to hear live music. More of it out there, all you entrepreneurs who are listening.
And the second track you heard there was Your Restless Heart by Chris Betts and his band Connection, and that was put together by his own production house, Pathfinder Productions. So thank you for Chris Betts' time and to Tony Gosling for his efforts. Well, it's time to hear the voice of Malcolm Grieve once again, and another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, which is written by John Fothergill, set in the 1920s. It's autobiographical work, as regular listeners will know. He went down to Tame in Oxfordshire with his family and moved into the Spread Eagle Inn. Not being a landlord before, he found it all a bit of a new experience. And this chapter is called Gastronomic Specialities.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Pritwit. Day after day passes. And it seems a waste of cellar and desire to put it in order, when not a dozen bottles go out. I'm hoping that this time next year we'll see a change, when my new stunt of selling by post to people who live in flats with flat purses, even one bottle at a time, though I would profit only tuppence on the single bottle, has had its chance. I recognise that a cash trade is hard to make. It would not be possible in Oxford, and hardly in London. In a little notice I have printed about selling wine in detail, with a mahogany-coloured cover so that you don't see them, though lying about on every table, I give a list of wines ending with, each of which is either drinkable or remarkable.
"Mr. Fothergill,"
called out Johnny Pritt, KC, in his nice loud voice before everyone at dinner,
"what should I do with a bottle of wine that is remarkable but not drinkable?"
But the sight of Molly Pritt put me at ease. Togo McLaurin and Mrs. are here for the weekend. He is a fat, innocent-eyed, beautifully mannered lad with lovely teeth. She is immense and fascinating. In the office after dinner, I was sitting opposite her while she was showing above her beautiful silk net stockings at least 8 inches of the inside of a smooth white thigh. McLaurin was sitting beside me too, when suddenly he said, "Darling, your dress has gone wrong." Instantly, she pulled up a bit of shoulder that was falling. The old pudor changeth, yielding place to new. 15 years ago, I told Will Rothenstein that I'd met at a party a beautiful lady whom I would ever remember as Lilla McArmpits, and he said that the dressmakers were at that moment deciding which part of the female body should be exposed next. Gypsies. It seems to me that the average actor takes to the job because he has the call of the wild. Sometimes they have lapses into humdrum bourgeois lawfulness. They contemplate a little home with little parties and gardens, get engaged and married on Saturday, and are off on Monday. This is an instance. A famous actress telegraphed here, at length wanting rooms for herself, her lady friend, maid, chauffeur, and a big car for the weekend. We sat up till 3 a.m, and they arrived and went to bed. Well, they came down at 1:30 next morning, empty of breakfast, and a man in another big car took them away, without their even saying good-bye. Why had they come? The little vagrants had had the bourgeois idea of a weekend in the perfect country, and they couldn't stand it. Not even in bed till 1:30. They'd even brought tennis rackets. The maid came and paid the bill and said the reason why they went was that it wasn't sufficient country for them, even in bed. This is strange, because they sent the maid to find the bathroom and she returned to say that it was too far away to go there. Surely a countrified enough condition of things. Or does the idea of too far point back to their gypsies' origin of living in the constrained area of a caravan? Bourgeois and simple again they became when they had ordered a big breakfast, which went up looking wonderful on a huge 18th-century mahogany oval tray. But when they saw it, back to the wild again, and they asked for it to be taken away, and the curtains redrawn. How good it is to be so natural, but how expensive. The fact is, 16 months without sunlight is telling its tale on all of us. Tonight it's howling as usual with wind, and no one came to dinner to eat what would have been no food, because the cook had spoiled it all when I had to be out of the kitchen for an hour. Moreover, we have with us a disagreeable stayer who hates us, very rich, and still stingier, whom we call Leatherface. But she's going on Tuesday. We've had this hate of females before, who, having the whole house to themselves and all the kindness of our servants, can only sit on their behinds and curse us inwardly. The only consolation is that in other inns they would curse outwardly. Public services. They asked me if I would stand for the Urban District Council. So I assented, very reluctantly. After having been posted up, a deputation of two men, one himself a councillor, representing a number of people, perhaps mythical, perhaps only the councillor himself, came to me in the garden and asked me if I, who was the only candidate, would stand down and so save an expensive election. Technically wrong, I believe. I got them to admit that their mission implied that they thought the possibility of my replacing one of the present councillors was not worth £25 to the town, even once in a century. I told them to go back and do an honest day's work. I'm glad to have got in. Finding that their meetings are held at the time our dinner began, I have resigned, and by way of redemption decorated the council room worthily of their work. Gastronomic specialities. The place with its specialité gastronomique is at least one better than the place with none. But you can't make a meal of écrevisse alone, or Grasmere gingerbread, Rouen duck, Edinburgh rock, or Westminster school pancake, or pâté de canard d'Amiens, especially as in these speciality places the rest of the food is extra meaningless. But where is it besides here that you get intention in everything? When I took this shop, I thought round for all the things I had found best wherever I'd been and sent for them. So Kate pays regular bills for foodstuff from Athens, France, Norway, Jaffa and Italy, and of English things. We have daily from three bakers three different kinds of bread made from flours that I have forced upon them, besides the bread that we make ourselves. Cheese from East Harptree, salt from Malden, mustard from Newport Pagnell, sausages after a romantic search all over England from Glenthorne in Tame, books from the Book Society, bacon found by accident at the international stores. For their ugly branch here, they tore down part of the most remarkable building in Tame, the Birdcage Inn, an obscenitaph to Lord Devonport. And despite the trouble, the net result upon the patient is that he is alive to something very different in the food. Real food is a surprise, and simply because the gastric juices fly out to it, whilst they hold back aching at the aromalessness of synthetic, poor or adulterated products. Surely this is better than buying all your stuff from an hotel purveyor, making out your quantities required on a big list, butter, coffee, coal, caviar, paraffin, all tasting the same, and all wrapped up in Murray Stope's paper. Even the coal. Surely this is better and more difficult than having one specialité gastronomique.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, let's find out what's going on this week, and let's hand over to Jeff Marks.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 12th of November, and Motorhead will be performing with support from The Damned and also Girls' School at the Colston Hall in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £25 in advance. Also on 12th of November, The Coal Porters will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance and £10 on the door. Moving on to Friday, 13th of November, They Will Rock You will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Rammstein. This group formed in Germany in 1994 and to date have released 6 studio albums. This is from their latest album, Lieb ist für all da, and is the track Weidmann's Heil, which roughly translates as a hunting song. We'll be right back. That was Rammstein with Weidmann's Heil from the album Lieb ist für all da. For more information, you can check out myspace.com/Rammstein. That is spelt Rammstein. Coming into Saturday, 14th of November, VV Brown will be performing at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £7.50 in advance. Also on 14th of November, Long Day Fear will be performing with support from Counterhold and Rebel Lust at Area 81 in Bristol. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, I come to Sunday, 15th of November, and Lost 11 will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect Radio is a weekly community internet radio show produced by volunteers and broadcast on BCFM, Bristol Community FM airwaves at 93.2, between Radio 3 and Radio 4, across the city at 9 o'clock every Saturday evening. If you're on the internet, you can find us at dialectradio.co.uk, that's all one word, and also at bristol.indymedia.org.uk, and you can always listen live on the BCFM website, which is bcfm.org.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you fancy the idea of getting involved, if you're not really sure what you want to do, you can just come along and watch. We need people to sort of go reporting or do engineering work. Please get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can go on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you very much to Anthea and Tony, Anthea Page and Tony Gosling for their features, and the studio production this week was by Mark Condon and Johnny Royden, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks and Malcolm Greaves for their input, and I've been John Peters Common, and I'm going to wish you a very good week. From all our team in Queen Square Studio in Bristol City Centre, thank you for your company, and we'll see you next week.